Simon of Cyrene, as a matter of fact, is mentioned by Matthew and Mark and Luke, and they say virtually the same thing about him in their respective accounts. They all refer to him by name. As a matter of fact, let's take this opportunity to go to Mark's account of Simon of Cyrene, Mark 15, verse 21, and see what Mark has to say about him there, because Mark gives a little bit more information about him. In Mark 15, verse 21, we find that it says, "And they pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross." This suggests to us that, as a matter of fact, he was a prominent disciple in the first century church. Now, let me say to you right now that some of the things I'm going to say in the introductory part of the lesson is speculative. As a matter of fact, some of these points, as we proceed through them, are going to become increasingly speculative. However, these first points about Simon, which I draw by implication or inference, since they're not absolutely stated to be facts in the Scriptures, I think are pretty strongly supported by the evidence. Some other points later on, not so much so. But for instance, this point that he was evidently a prominent disciple in the first century church, I think is pretty well supported by the evidence that we do have for that conclusion. Remember again that he's mentioned by name by Matthew and Mark and Luke. This suggests very strongly to us that their readers must have known who he was. Otherwise, why mention him by name? And these books, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, were probably written to Christians originally. And so why write to members of the church in various places? Why write to Christians and mention this fellow Simon of Cyrene by name and his story as if it's important, all three of them do, if he was not a disciple of Jesus Christ, and a prominent disciple, a well-known disciple of Jesus Christ at that? Now here in Mark, as a matter of fact, which we've just read, Mark 15, verse 21, parenthetically, as a matter of fact, his sons are mentioned by name. That even adds more evidence to the fact that he was must have been known to Mark's readers. Why mention not only Simon of Cyrene, but also his sons, Alexander and Rufus, if they're not Christians? So we may conclude from that they evidently were Christians also. There surely would not have been an occasion for mentioning his sons, Alexander and Rufus, if they were not only Christians, but also well-known Christians, at least among the Romans. As a matter of fact, it's interesting, if I may proceed on this point a little bit more, that supposedly, and there's good evidence for this, Mark wrote his gospel particularly originally to the Christians in the city of Rome. And then when we come to Romans, the 16th chapter, verse 13, remembering that the letter to the Romans was written by Paul, we find there that Paul makes reference to a certain Rufus among his greetings that he gives, a fairly long list of people that he had to greet there in the 16th chapter of Romans. And particularly in verse 13, it says, "Greet Rufus, a choice or chosen man in the Lord, also his mother and mine." Now, bear in mind that Romans here, well, of course, was written to Romans. That's where it got its name. Mark, which also mentions Alexander and Rufus, was supposedly written to the Romans. Evidently, this Rufus in Romans 16, verse 13, was a fairly prominent disciple. He's spoken of as a chosen man, a special disciple, a good, faithful disciple. This leads to the conclusion that this Rufus was a strong member of the church in Rome, probably to be identified with the Rufus mentioned in Mark 15, verse 21, who was a son of Simon of Cyrene. And evidently, Rufus's mother, that is, the wife of Simon of Cyrene, if you agree with me in these conclusions, was also a prominent sister in the church at Rome. As a matter of fact, Paul identifies her as his mother. Now, I don't take that literally. Some might. As a matter of fact, I can't prove that she would not be his biological mother. If that's the case, then it would seem that Simon of Cyrene was Paul's father. I doubt that, since Paul was from Tarsus in Cilicia, and Simon, of course, is from Cyrene. So it's probably an honorary title that Paul gives to Rufus's mother when he says, she is my mother also. In other words, our relationship is so close, and I regard her with such high esteem that she is effectively my mother. But in any event, what can we conclude from this? If we can make all of these connections, assuming we can make all of these connections, and I think that that's likely, we can conclude from this evidently that Simon of Cyrene, who carried the cross of Christ, had apparently become a Christian, and a strong Christian, a well-known Christian. Not only that, he had an influence over his family members, his sons, Alexander and Rufus, so that they also became Christians, good, strong Christians, and his wife, who also became a well-known Christian in Rome. Now, to appreciate how this might have happened, that is, how Simon would have become a Christian, how his wife and then the sons would have become a Christian, to appreciate how all of this happened, it's important for us, I think, to consider more closely the only picture of Simon of Cyrene that we have given to us in the New Testament. In one version of that, Mark 15, verse 21, we've already read. There's not much there. But we do know that he was of or from Cyrene, which was, according to Acts 2, verse 10, a city in North Africa, particularly Libya. As a matter of fact, the modern country of Libya has been in the news lately. Well, Simon was from a prominent city in the ancient country of Libya. And as a matter of fact, there had, for centuries, been a prominent colony of Jews there. And perhaps Simon of what was among the Cyrenian Jews who are mentioned as being present to hear the apostles preach in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost. We gather that information from Acts 2, verse 10. Some of the people there were from the city of Cyrene. Maybe Simon was among them. The Jews of Cyrene, as a matter of fact, were so prominent that they had their own synagogue, or they had co-founded a synagogue according to Acts 6, verse 9. In Acts 11, verse 20, we find that the Jewish saints, Jewish Christians from Cyrene, helped start what, according to the New Testament record, is the first Gentile church in Antioch of Syria. That's in Acts 11, verse 20. And then we have this information, and we're getting into the part that I said is going to become increasingly speculative. So I'm not going to press this as much or say that this has as much evidence behind it, because I don't think that it does. But it's interesting, nevertheless, to consider. It says in Acts 13, verse 1, now there was an Antioch in the church that was there, prophets and teachers, Barnabas and Simeon, who was called Niger, and Lucius of Cyrene, and Manion, who had been brought up with Herod, the Tetrarch, and Saul. Now, notice coupled there is a certain Simeon. Simeon is a variant spelling of Simon. Just drop the E out of Simeon and you get Simon. So there are two different forms of the same name. So this Simeon could also be called Simon. As a matter of fact, sometimes Simon Peter is called Simeon in the New Testament. Now, especially if you put brackets or parentheses, I should say, around that expression who was called Niger. Simeon, here in Acts 13, verse 1, it says, was called Niger. You put, make that a parenthetical expression, who was called Niger. Put, you know, in your mind, put parentheses around it. Then you can see more easily that this Simeon or Simon is coupled with Lucius of Cyrene. And the author could be saying this is the Simon along with Lucius, both of them being from Cyrene. If that's the case, you could say perhaps, and I think some have said this, that this Simon here is the same one who carried the cross of Christ. He had gone to Antioch to teach. As a matter of fact, it says in Acts 11, verse 20, that some Cyrenian Jewish Christians had gone to Antioch to teach there and help start the church there. So it could be that this, the one who carried the cross of Christ, Simon of Cyrene, become a Christian, was even a prophet and a teacher who had settled at least for a while there in Antioch of Syria and was teaching. Again, I acknowledge that's getting pretty speculative. We can't nail that down by any means. But I am more confident, and to a large extent, my points, and this is important, my points later on in the lesson are going to be based on the assumption, which I think is a pretty good, strong assumption, well-supported assumption from the Scriptures, that Simon eventually himself became a disciple of Christ and also brought his wife and his sons to Christ also. So, Simon was made to bear the cross of Christ for him. This was not an unusual practice. By the way, this map shows you where Cyrene was here on the north coast of the large African continent there in Libya. And there are evidently even some, well, you can see here some fairly prominent ruins left behind there at where Cyrene was located. This Simon from Cyrene is made to carry the cross of Christ. And this was not unusual. Christ in several places, particularly in Matthew 10, verse 38, speaks of his disciples as taking up their own cross and following him. This is probably an allusion to the fact that probably all of the time, crucifixion victims were made to carry their own crosses to the execution site. This was the case with Christ. According to John, Christ started off bearing his own cross. And then according to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, evidently later on, Simon was impressed into the service to carry Christ's cross for him. But we'll get to that, I suppose, momentarily. But right now, I just want to observe that it was evidently the routine practice for those who were to be crucified to be made to carry their own crosses. This was the case with Christ. But in Christ's case, he was probably so debilitated from having been lashed so many times, scourged, probably to the point that he had bled out a lot. His back, his skin thereon might have been hanging by shreds after these vicious scourgings, that he was either unable to finish or he was just going too slow for the Roman soldiers, and they got impatient and they grabbed Simon and said, "Here, you carry the cross for him." Christ might have made it from the Roman praetorium where he was tried all the way to the gate of Jerusalem, and there it simply became too much for him, or as I said, the Roman soldiers got tired of the slow pace and got someone else to carry it for him. Excuse me. The Romans were used to requisitioning anyone or anything that they wanted, that they felt that they needed. As a matter of fact, this might explain what seems like a strange statement in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, particularly in Matthew 5, verse 41. There Jesus says, "And whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go with him too." The Greek word translated force here in the New American Standard Version of Matthew 5:41 is exactly the word used by Matthew and Mark to describe the fact that Simon was forced or compelled to carry Jesus' cross. Same word. And what Jesus is alluding here is to the fact that if Roman soldiers, for instance, or officials, were having to carry some sort of burden, like a cross, but it didn't have to be a cross. If they were on a mission, an official mission somewhere, and maybe it didn't even have to be official, they could be rather brutal people to the Jews when they wanted to be. The Jews were being dominated by the Romans. Their country was occupied by the Romans. And so when Romans were on a mission, or even if they, perhaps they weren't on a mission, but they wanted somebody, a Jew, to carry something for them, just a regular civilian, they would say, "Hey, you, over here, pick up this thing, carry it for me." And Jesus is saying, rather than hating someone because of that, rather than lashing out and being vengeful, or even trying to kill that person, if you have the opportunity, instead do the very opposite. Instead, go 2 miles with that person instead of the 1 mile that he wants you to go with him. So that may be the background for this statement in Matthew 5, verse 41. But in any event, we would expect crucifixion victims like Christ to be forced to carry their own cross. And if they couldn't do it, then if somebody is standing nearby, just grab him and make him do it. And this is apparently what happened to Simon of Cyrene. Now, people have really gotten speculative also about why Simon of Cyrene was picked. I've read that some people thought that Simon looked at Jesus sympathetically, and so because of that, the Roman soldiers grabbed him and made him carry Christ's cross. They may find other reasons. He might have been just looking with interest at what was going on, and so forth. Some might even speculate that he was already a disciple of Christ. I don't think we need to go that far. I think it's enough to say he was standing by, he was watching. I mean, you know how people rubberneck when they pass an accident. They want to look at it and see what's going on. Well, here's a crucifixion party going by. If Simon's coming in from the country, even though he was not originally part of the observers of this affair, he's going to stop and he's going to look at what's going on. And that's going to give the Roman soldiers an opportunity to say, "Hey, you, get over here and carry this cross for him." So he was, I would think, most likely arbitrarily chosen. But whatever might have been the reason for him being chosen to carry Jesus' cross, he had to comply. Luke says, they laid hold of him. They grabbed him. They put their hands on him. "Come over here." And placed the cross on him. So this was something that was imposed on him, and he had no choice about it. Let's now consider three lessons that we can learn from this very short story of Simon of Cyrene. And the first of these that I would like to draw to your attention is this lesson. What at first seems to be a burden to us may turn out to be a great blessing for us. And that's a lesson that we certainly need to learn. That there can be a silver lining in every cloud. As a matter of fact, as I reflect back upon my life, I have been able to observe that, and I observe this after I come out of those difficult periods, because when you're going through it, you're not inclined to think this way. But when you look retrospectively back at difficult periods, at least I have found them to be some of my best learning periods. I learned from those difficult situations. I didn't like them. I didn't invite them. I didn't want them. But nevertheless, I had to endure them. I had to cope with them. I had to deal with situations. And they forced me, you know, it's a make or break situation perhaps. You know, either you're going to grow up and or you're going to deal with this in a mature fashion, or you're not. It's going to break you. And you have to make that decision. And once you come out of those situations, then you may find out, looking back upon them, you know what? I grew from that situation. It was difficult at the time. I regarded it as a burden at the time, but it has turned out to be a great blessing to me. You know, it must have been hard and humiliating for Simon to have to carry Jesus' cross. When he was going into Jerusalem that morning, he apparently had no idea that he would be put in a position to be made to do this. And when he was made to carry this cross, surely he thought, well, there's nothing good that can come out of this. This is just something that I'm going to have to do because I'm made to do it. But it's a hard situation. It's degrading and I don't want to do it, but I have to do it. And yet, this intersection of his life with that of Jesus turned out to be the pivotal, critical point of his life, assuming that he then became a disciple of Jesus. Crossing paths with Christ, who was on his way to death, put Simon on the pathway to eternal life. This meeting with Christ on the road to Golgotha was almost certainly the critical factor in him and his wife and his sons being saved. He was confronted by the death of this man who was a stranger to him. Confronted by him in such a dramatic, we might even say traumatic way, that he had to come to grips with its meaning. Yes, I say he had to come to grips with its meaning. Have you ever been with someone who has died? Actually watched them die? I never have. I've not gotten that close to death. But even if that person might be a stranger to you, maybe you come up on an accident on the roadside and you stop to render first aid. You don't even know the person's name. But you become involved by virtue of this unforeseen accident that you come upon. You become intimately involved in this person's life because you're trying to save this person's life. And if you succeed in doing that, then you're probably going to become even more involved in that person's life because that person is going to be appreciative, no doubt, for what you did to save his or her life. But even if that person dies, you've become locked into that person's final moments. And that's a very intimate position to be in. And no doubt, if that were to happen to you, you'd want to know, how did the accident happen? How did this person come to be in this situation? What was this person's name? How old was this person? And you're going to inquire about the person. Why? Because this person has become, well, part of your emotional life because you have been with this person in this near-death experience or maybe in a death experience. This was Simon's position. He's going along, he's minding his own business, and all of a sudden, he comes upon this execution party. A man is going to his death, and lo and behold, he's picked out of the crowd, and he's told to carry this very man's cross. And what does he have to do? The cross is placed upon him, he falls in behind Christ. Luke says that he followed him, or got behind him. And there he was on the way to Golgotha. Christ is in front of him with his bloody, shredded back, perhaps the skin hanging off his back in shreds. And Simon is following him down the road to Golgotha, a man who's already suffered a great deal and is about to die. And he's carrying his instrument of death. He has become very involved with Christ. Don't you think he's going to want to know, even though Christ was a stranger to him, apparently, don't you think he's going to want to know something about Christ? Don't you think that this is going to be a traumatizing event, to some extent anyway, for Simon of Cyrene? And that this event left an indelible impression on his mind. So he must have wanted to know who Jesus was, and what he had done to be crucified. And then as a result of making inquiries about Jesus, he came to know something about Christ, something about his life, and something about his message. Well, if we may speculate a little bit more and follow it out a little bit more, okay, he's got these questions about Christ. Imagine him being told upon inquiring, this Jesus was crucified by Jews with the help of the Romans, because he claimed to be the King of Israel. He claimed to be the Son of God. He was a blasphemer. And then Simon's going to ask more questions, and he's going to find out more, okay, about the claims of Jesus at least. But what does he do with those claims? Then, perhaps about 50 days later, he heard Peter and the other apostles on Pentecost in Jerusalem preach that the very man whose cross he had not long before carried to his execution site had been raised from the dead. Now, think about what must be going through Simon's mind when he hears this message. Okay, you mean that man whose cross I carried to the execution site? The man who claimed to be the King of Israel and was for that reason crucified? The Son of God? That man, they're saying, is raised from the dead? What evidence is there for that? Of course, part of the evidence is the empty tomb. But now, because Simon has gotten so intimately involved with Christ and has carried his cross to the execution site, he's not going to be like a lot of other Jews. Now, any other Jew, when they heard this message, they're probably going to give rein to their prejudice. And they're going to be disinclined to believe in Christ. And like most Jews, they're just going to reject the claims of Christ and find some excuse for not accepting. Don't look too deeply into the evidence. That's how people get away with not believing. They don't take the time to look deeply into the evidence because they don't want to believe. And when you don't want to believe something, you don't look at the evidence, do you? Okay? But now here's Simon of Cyrene. He doesn't have that luxury. He's already been called up with Christ. He carried the cross of Christ. So, he's going to be interested in finding out. Now, this man whose cross I carried to his death, and who claims to be the Son of God, and now you're preaching he's been raised from the dead. I've got to know about this. I want to know. I want to be sure, because I was with this man in his last hours. I carried his execution instrument for him. Well, as I stated toward the beginning of this lesson, apparently he became convinced by the evidence, and he came to believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, and became a disciple of Christ. And apparently, wherever he went, and we judge this from the fact that Matthew, Mark, and Luke all mention his story. And as a matter of fact, if Simon of Cyrene had not become a Christian, I'm not sure the story would have been worth mentioning, particularly even giving his name, the name of an unbeliever. But wherever he went, in the church particularly, he was undoubtedly thereafter known as the man who carried the cross of Christ. There was a movie made one time starring... Well, John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart. I forget the other guy's name. Anyway, the movie was entitled The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. And he apparently, because he was thought to have shot Liberty Valance, who was basically an outlaw, this is an old black and white movie. Those of you who are young wouldn't have any chance of knowing anything about it, but that doesn't matter. But anyway, he apparently was able to ride his fame based on the fact that he had shot this outlaw, Liberty Valance. He was able to ride his fame to the point that he became a U.S. Senator. But yet that's what he was known all of his life as. The man who shot Liberty Valance. Well, here's Simon of Cyrene. For a few hours, maybe much less. He was caught up with Christ in the last hours before Christ's death, carried his cross, and I hope we didn't lose anything here, did we? Okay. But he was caught up with Christ, and for thereafter, it seems, he was remembered as the man who carried the cross of Christ. It's possible that none of this would have happened had Simon not met Christ on the road to Golgotha. In other words, if he hadn't carried the cross of Christ, if their paths had not crossed, then Simon might not have become a Christian. What had at first been forced on Simon as something that was horrendous, repulsive, and arduous, a terrible burden. Well, Christ was able to take that and turn it into a great blessing and honor. Now let me ask you this. What if you had been there? What if you'd seen Christ struggling under the burden of this cross? What would you have wanted to do? Well, assuming that you're a Christian and you appreciate the significance of the cross of Christ, wouldn't you say, Christ, let me carry it for you? Wouldn't you jump out there, take the cross off his back, put it on your own, even help him up if necessary, and say, I'll follow you to Calvary, and I'll carry your cross for you. Wouldn't you consider it a profound privilege to carry his cross? Wouldn't you want to be known as the one who carried the cross of Christ for him? Wouldn't you want to be known? Or perhaps I should say, wouldn't you want to take the place of Simon of Cyrene? Oh, Simon of Cyrene, right at that point, he wouldn't have wanted to carry the cross of Christ. He was made to do so. But from your perspective now, if you are a Christian, wouldn't you have considered it a privilege had you been there and an honor to assume what Simon at the time no doubt considered a terrible burden? You know, we need to remember that events in our lives can be good or bad depending on the attitude that we adopt toward them. They can be good or bad depending on our response to them. You know, we can't control what happens in our lives sometimes. Things just happen to us over which we have no control sometimes. But how we respond to those events is something we can control. We can respond badly, or we can respond in a good way. We can look at them as burdens, or we can see in them blessings. Because hidden in life's harshest burdens can be the seed of the greatest blessings that life has to offer us. So again, the first lesson, what at first seems to be a burden can be a blessing. And we need to remember that. The second point, or lesson I wish to give you from Simon of Cyrene is this. Following close on the heels of the last point. In fact, to be a disciple of Christ, we've got to carry the cross of Christ. I asked you just a moment ago, what if you had been there and had seen Christ struggling under his cross? Would you have happily jumped out and said, Christ, I will carry your cross. I will gladly do so. Well, as a matter of fact, that's precisely what we have to do as disciples of Christ today. Salvation requires cross bearing. Let's look in Matthew 10, verse 38. And this is just one of several times where Christ made the statement, if you want to be my disciple, you've got to carry your cross. But I think this one is representative. It says, and he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. That statement is made as perhaps five or six times in Matthew, Mark, and Luke put together. We cannot be disciples of Christ if we each do not take up our cross and follow Christ. As a matter of fact, what we do with the cross in carrying it daily is a recapitulation of the trial, the cross-bearing, the death, and the resurrection of Christ. In other words, we must repeat those things. We must follow Christ and do what He did, including bearing a cross. Let me be more specific. Because of sin, each person is tried in the balances, so to speak, by God and is found lacking, just as Christ was tried. Like Christ, each must take up his cross. Like Christ, each must go outside the city of his past to Golgotha. Christ was crucified outside the city of Jerusalem. As a matter of fact, the writer of Hebrews, in Hebrews 13, you might wish to turn in your Bibles there now. In Hebrews 13, verses 12 and 13, the writer of Hebrews makes a point from the fact that Christ suffered outside the city of Jerusalem. Now, his point, in particular in the context of Hebrews, is that you've got to leave Judaism behind. You've got to leave Jerusalem behind. You've got to go outside the city, just as Christ was put to death outside the city. Beginning in verse 12 of Hebrews 13, we know that it says, "Therefore Jesus also, that He might sanctify the people through His own blood, suffered outside the gate. Hence, let us go out to Him outside the camp," or the city, "bearing His reproach." The Jews had to leave their beloved Judaism behind when they embraced Christ. Likewise, we today have got a past that we've got to leave behind. Maybe something we cherish. But we've got to go outside the city of our past. Suffer outside the gate. Relinquishing what we had in the past. And then, each must be crucified with Christ to sin. You know, Angel read from Romans 6, verses 1 through 11, where Paul writes in what is perhaps the most extensive commentary on this point. Let me catch up here. Here we are. In Romans 6, we've got to be crucified. Not only do we bear the cross, but we go beyond what Simon did at that point. We're not literally crucified, but spiritually we are crucified to sin. We die to sin. And there are several points in Galatians, which we'll turn to now, where Paul makes this comparison between the crucifixion of Christ and the Christian's crucifixion. The Christian doesn't literally die on a cross, but he is crucified, or he dies to sin, to his past. In Galatians 2, verse 20, for instance, Paul says, "I have been crucified with Christ, and it is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. In the life which I now live in flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and delivered Himself up for me." Likewise, in chapter 5, verse 24, Paul there says, "Now those who belong to Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires." And finally, in chapter 6, verse 14, he says, "But may it never be that I should boast except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, through which the world has been crucified to me and I to the world." So you see, at each step in coming to Christ, we repeat or recapitulate what He did. He was tried. He had to take up His cross. He had to go outside the city. And there He was crucified. And not only that, but He was killed. He died, that is. He was buried. And then the third day, as we know according to the Scriptures, He was raised from the dead. That's what happens to us when we obey the gospel and particularly are baptized. And again, Angel read from Romans 6, verses 1 through 11. But that's exactly the point that Paul is making there. We cannot continue in sin. Why? Because we've been crucified to sin. We've died to sin. We've been buried in the waters of baptism. We've been buried with Christ. He died to sin. We died to sin. He was buried. We are buried. He in the tomb. We in the water of baptism. And then we're raised to walk in newness of life. Christ was revived. Or I should say, he was resurrected. And in a sense, came to, again to life. You might say, a newness of life. And likewise, we are raised from the watery grave of baptism to walk in newness of life. And then, like Simon, we've got to take up our cross daily and fall in behind Christ. The third and last lesson I would like to mention to you is this. The obligation to take up Christ's cross will always confront people. Maybe you and me. At a time and place that we neither expect nor desire. You know, I can't imagine that it would ever have occurred to Simon when he was going into Jerusalem that morning that he would be called up in, of all things, a crucifixion party. Last thing he imagined. Perhaps he was on his way to do some business in the city of Jerusalem. We don't know. Perhaps he was on his way to some Passover festivities. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, at least, was still going on. Whatever may have been the case, he was on his way out of the country into the city of Jerusalem. And whatever plans he had for that day were just obliterated. He was shocked, perhaps even traumatized by the fact he's forced to carry a dying man's cross for him to a place where he's going to be put to death. His plans were completely frustrated, whatever they might have been. He found himself having to reverse his steps. Whereas he had been going into Jerusalem to do whatever he was going to do, now he finds himself all of a sudden stopped, forced to carry this stranger's cross and retrace his steps and go back out of the city of Jerusalem. He had to change direction. No doubt, if he could have, he would have avoided that. If he had been asked before he got to that point, Simon, would you like to carry someone's cross today? No. That's the last thing I'd want to do. He would have avoided it if he could. He would have resisted being pressed into service. But he had to do it. The Roman soldiers made him do it. It was not what he planned, not what he wanted, not what he expected. He was surprised by it. But he had to do it. He would not have chosen this particular moment. He would not have chosen these circumstances to have his encounter with Christ. If he had any encounter with Christ, he would have wanted it to be a more comfortable circumstances. Maybe something like Nicodemus in John 3 where he goes to Christ at night and asks him a question. Now he's out in public and he's having to bear this man's cross. That's how he is confronted by Christ. After all, Luke says, what was it? He was just a passerby. He was going about his own business, minding his own business, would have preferred that everybody else do their thing and mind their own business. He might have said, if he looked at Jesus, poor fellow, I'd hate to be in his shoes. But, you know, it's not my problem. None of my business. It's hardly worth my interest. Just something passing by, and then I'll move on. But he wasn't given that luxury. Perhaps God's providence intervened at this time and arranged for Simon to have this brush with Christ. In any event, it's interesting. He had just finished his Passover meal of lamb, And now he's about to begin life with the real Passover lamb. Like Simon, many people, perhaps the vast majority of people, are content to relate to Christ as nothing more than passers-by. We just want to pass Christ by. You know, don't want to get too involved with Christ. You know, he's not that much of my business. You know, maybe they'll tip their hat to him, you know, as they're passing by, nod, greet him in some way, give him some sort of acknowledgement, but nothing more. They really don't want to get involved. They just want to be related to him as passers-by. You see, they've got more important things in life, bigger fish to fry, so to speak. They're on their way to the pursuit of their of matters of their own choosing, what they consider their real important business. They've got their own interest, and they know what is important for them, and they don't want to be distracted by Christ or interrupted from what they're going to do by anything Christ might have to say to them. You see, they're on a mission. You know, it seems like everybody has a mission. He's on a mission. Or they're on a mission of some sort of self-imposed importance. And nothing ought to interfere with it. They've got their own lives. Other people have their lives. Don't bother me. I won't bother you. So they're on their way to do something. And then all of a sudden, Christ intrudes upon their lives. This is not what they would have wanted, not what they would have expected. Maybe they have some sort of problem in their life. And they're made to think on spiritual things. Maybe they have a confrontation with death in a way, terminal illness, an accident. Maybe something like that forces them. They didn't plan it, but it forces them to think on spiritual things, as was the case with Simon here. They would not have had their business interrupted, but God intrudes and says, in effect, you need to put your mind on what is really important and need to see things differently. They might say, well, you know, it's not part of my schedule right now. But listen, salvation is not something to be scheduled. God does not leave sinners the luxury of choosing the time when they are ready to take up the cross of Christ. I had someone recently say to me, someone involved in sin, knew she should have been doing better than she was doing, I'm not ready yet. You know, that's probably, I'm sure that's not the first time I've heard that. People in effect say, well, I'll come to Christ when I'm ready. I'm not ready yet. Well, you think God works according to our schedules? You think He's going to be put off like that? Time and circumstances, sometimes unexpected, sometimes unwanted, intrude themselves and leave the lives of sinners recognized as having something lacking in them. These sinners are preoccupied with other things, but God intrudes into their lives sometimes in a certain way as to tell them this is what is really important. And that's what happened to Simon, it would seem. Now, some may cry out, well, I'm not ready yet. Or, it's not a good time for me. It's not a convenient time, like Felix in Acts 24, verse 25. When I find time, I will summon you. Well, what does God say in response? He may say, it's now or never. You don't have the luxury of choosing when you will become a disciple of Christ. It may be that the opportunity to be saved, once proudly spurned, may never come again. Some people say, I'm not ready yet. But readiness is something made. It's not something to be waited for. If you just wait for it, it may never come. You have to make yourself ready. In conclusion then, it's interesting that, in fact, there were two Simons who were confronted with the cross of Christ that day. One of them, of course, was Simon Peter. What did he do? Well, he ran from the cross of Christ, even denied Christ in the process of doing so. And then, of course, there was the other Simon, whom we've talked about today. at first compelled to carry the cross of Christ, he thereafter apparently freely chose it and even embraced it. Now, as was the case with Simon that day, each person may find the cross of Christ getting in his way. I've got other things to do. I don't want to be bothered with that right now. So the cross of Christ gets in his way. But when that happens, he can either see it as being in his way, or he can see it as being his way. That is, his way to heaven. He can see it as a barrier, detouring him, diverting him to hell because he rejects the cross, or he can see the cross of Christ as a ladder inviting him to heaven. It may be that there is at least one person here today who now sees the privilege and the honor that Simon of Cyrene had in bearing the cross of Christ. Even though he undoubtedly regarded it as a burden at first, it became a great blessing for him. Why not today choose to carry the cross of Christ? Crucify the world to you, to yourself, and see the cross of Christ as a ladder that can take you to heaven. Come forward in faith and in repentance to confess before your faith in Christ, and then die to sin. Be buried in the waters of baptism. Be raised to walk in newness of life. If you have done that, but since then have let the cross drop and you're perhaps you've been loath to pick it up again, and you've given your life to sin, you wish to come before us and make confession of those sins and put yourself back on the road to heaven again with our prayers and with our encouragement and help. If that's your desire also, we bid you too to come as together we stand and sing.